Welcome to Neurosalience, the OHBM podcast.
Welcome to the Organization for Human Brain Mapping Neurosalience podcast. I'm Peter Banatini, and here I discuss all things brain imaging with scientists from around the world. Today, it's my pleasure to talk with Dr. Monica Rosenberg. Dr. Rosenberg received her PhD from the Department of Psychology at Yale University, where she also carried out her postdoc. In 2019, she started as an assistant professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Chicago and is a member of the Chicago Neuroscience Institute. She's been pioneering the use of connectome-based predictive modeling to capture individual differences in the ability to sustain attention. Attention is fundamental to just about everything that we experience and do and how we navigate the world. It varies over time, and each person has different abilities to maintain it. Monica has developed and used extensively a task known as GRAD-CPT, an easy at first but hard to sustain continuous attention test that allows moment-to-moment assessment of sustained attention. She's found two networks that characterize high attention versus lower attention. And these have been powerful for characterizing individuals' ability to sustain attention. It's been also useful for characterizing differences in such attention-related skills, such as reading comprehension. She's been delving further into both fMRI methodology and the nuances of attention ever since. In this conversation, we talk about her career development, the great environment at Yale for fostering her graduate work and postdoc work, the development of her exciting and impactful fMRI-based human attention research, and her start at the University of Chicago. I really enjoyed this and learned quite a bit. Her enthusiasm is absolutely infectious, and her general approach to research and science is inspiring. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Today we have Monica Rosenberg, who has been doing amazing work over the last several years at Yale, and now she's at the University of Chicago, using predictive models for understanding attention. And, you know, we've actually used her paradigms and also her networks for predicting things like even, you know, reading acuity and things like that. So we're going to talk all about this and go from there. So Monica, welcome.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So I think I first met you maybe 8 years ago or 7 years ago, just when you were sort of, you know, starting to publish really, really, I mean, great work coming out of Yale, you know, you and Emily Finn and a few other people. I mean, you had something novel and you were publishing great work, all kind of together as a team in some sense. And you distinguished yourself just by publishing this work, focusing more on predicting attention and the ability to attend. And, you know, obviously many people have that ability to different degrees. And then of course there's people with ADHD who, you know, we need to understand that more, but also try to predict that or maybe do something about it. And so let's just back up even further than graduate school at the very beginning. So either during your undergraduate or even earlier. So what made you first interested in neuropsychology or even brain imaging?
It's a good question. And the answer is really just serendipitous. So I grew up in Rhode Island and I was doing a high school English project where I had to go to the library and like look up references. It was like our big first research project. And I had a friend whose dad was a doctor at Brown and he had access to the library at Brown. So we like made the trip up to Providence in Rhode Island, like that was far, even though it was maybe like 25 minutes. And when we were walking to the library, we passed this building. And at Brown, there's the department used to be called the Cognitive and Linguistic Sciences. And I passed the Cognitive and Linguistic Sciences building. And I thought, oh, that's weird. That's interesting. What might that be? And looked it up. And I just decided, this is fascinating. This is what I am really interested in studying. When I actually got to college, I thought, okay, let me actually do something practical. I just like would imagine my future and see some ambiguous office with a suit or something. I don't really know. But I tried these different classes that were more practically minded and they just like didn't capture my heart. And so I was super lucky. I ended up going to Brown and they have an undergraduate major in cognitive neuroscience. And they also don't have like distribution requirements. So I took a lot of very focused classes and just, you know, haven't looked back since.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool. That's cool. It's interesting how, yeah, how certain things just sort of catch your interest. And mm-hmm. I know the feeling of like sort of being in classes where you're like, oh, this just doesn't resonate with me. This is just stuff that, and this is what I, you know, you kind of have to listen to yourself to find your passion.
Yeah. Like I, you know, could do other things, but I was never excited to, you know, go to my political science class or whatever other class I was trying. So yeah, I'm happy where I ended up.
That's awesome. And it was serendipitous in some sense, because you actually mm-hmm. went to a great, obviously going to Yale was great. And, but it's interesting too, because, you know, I think what, when people think of your group that you worked with, it was mostly, they think of Todd Constable, at least I think of Todd Constable, but you know, he's more of a physicist, you know, he's sort of kind of like me, who's sort of moving into cognitive neuroscience. But it, was he your advisor, or was this somebody else that he was like co-advising, or?
So my primary advisor was Marvin Chun in psychology. So this was also serendipitous, you know, to work with a team. So I, you know, attribute a lot of things that have happened along my career to just pure luck. And I think this was one of them. So I, after I graduated from undergrad, worked as a research assistant with Mike Esterman at the Boston VA and studied sustained attention. And I found it totally fascinating because it's something that resonates with everyone, right? No matter who you are, you probably have had the experience where you want to focus on what you're reading, but your eyes skim across a page. You don't remember what you just read, right? You're trying to focus and you just are not. And why is that happening? And so I went to Yale for my PhD to work with Marvin Chun. And in the first year, Emily Finn, who was in your lab, you know well, yeah. She was in Todd Constable's lab in the interdepartmental neuroscience program. And in that program, you have to rotate between labs. She knew she wanted to join Todd's lab, but she did a rotation in Marvin's lab because he was doing relevant work. So she rotated in the lab, and then she and I met and we became friends. And then we just started working together because we were friends. And so it just random happenstance brought this larger group together. And I feel really lucky to, you know, have been a part of it.
Yeah, I think there's something to say for having another person and having some synergy with either another person or another few people, as opposed to just working with yourself with a distributed group that's sort of only loosely attached, because you get a resonance, and then that is motivating in many ways. So that's awesome. That's awesome. And yeah, and then so you continued on. And so what made you, I guess Marvin Chun was maybe focusing on attention as well, like you were, mm-hmm. like you were saying. And so, and then certainly, right. I mean, that was one of the things now that's part of Todd's group. And in general is sort of the idea of, you know, that's one of the holy grails of fMRI in some sense is, you know, finding signatures that either define, you know, biomarkers with groups or define individuals or define states over time. And attention mm-hmm. lends itself perfectly to that.
It's sort of related to all of them. It's interesting because my very first projects in graduate school were really trying to understand attention fluctuations. So why are there some moments where we're engaged, other moments we're distracted and mind wandering, you know, even if we're motivated to focus the whole time. But then, you know, I moved to individual differences, and that's what became the focus of my dissertation, was using, you know, differences in patterns of functional connectivity during task and during rest between people to learn things about how well they performed attention tasks and, you know, some things about their attention-related clinical symptoms. And then since then, I've kind of gone back into fluctuation land and still do individual differences work, of course, but a lot of the work in my lab is actually focused now on going back and trying to uncover at those moments of time when we're engaged in what we're doing, when we're not, can we predict those moments? What consequences do they have for memory and learning? And so it's sort of gone full circle in that sense.
Yeah. Okay. All right. And there's so much more. I mean, so it's interesting. So I actually was, you know, as I was researching this and thinking about this, I mean, I really started not really obsessing over it, but I was thinking, okay, attention, this is an interesting, is it because I'm thinking, okay, so the brain is, you know, there's different dimensions. There's like arousal, that's sort mm-hmm. of a general increase of attention. But then once you have like a constant arousal, it's like, it seems like your attention is always directed somewhere. So there's always attention, but it's just sustaining that in a way that with a task that may not be, that takes some effort to sustain it. And so that's more, I guess, control in some sense, or mm-hmm. you know, inhibiting yourself from, well, maybe we might get into more of this later, but, and also researching this a little bit more, and you know, a couple years ago, I interviewed Rizzo Corbetta, who sort of defined his career at the very beginning of coming up with, you know, interceptor versus, you know, outside world attention. And so how did you pick up on, maybe, I mean, I'm sure you probably read his work, and how does this, and we'll get into, I'm getting ahead of myself, but we'll get into the task itself and then the analysis, but maybe talk a little bit about how you put your work against the backdrop of what has been done, and what's the sort of angle and how you're advancing at it in that regard.
Yes, it's a really good question. And I often fall into the trap of, when I give a talk, just talking about attention, right? I hear I'm doing that, but really I'm talking about a particular component of attention. And I think you've nicely highlighted, like, attention is not just one thing. My advisor, Marvin Chun, has a great paper about a taxonomy of internal and external attention. And I think one of the challenges in attention research is attention can mean so many things, but it's not just one thing. One of my favorite definitions of attention, it comes from that paper from Chun and colleagues. And it's, you know, attention is the way the brain controls its own information processing. But the way that happens in different perceptual systems, memory systems, learning, decision making could be different. And so there's sort of lots of different kinds of attentional processes. And I think a challenge for attention researchers is defining exactly what those are. What is the sort of taxonomy or ontogeny of attention? What I have focused on primarily is sustained attention. And one of my favorite definitions of sustained attention actually echoes, like, almost exactly what you previewed before. So it's perfect. It's from a review paper from Mike Esterman, who described, you know, if arousal is, you know, the theoretical amount of resources you have available, sustained attention is how you direct those resources, right? So exactly as you said, how you devote those to a task, how you focus on a particular, you know, goal-directed action at the expense of other distracting information in the periphery, and so on. And so I'm mostly focused on that component of attention, sustained attention, but I'm also really interested in saying, what are sort of the unique functional signatures of individual differences and fluctuations in sustained attention versus other kinds of attention? Because just because we might have strong sustained attention doesn't necessarily mean we're going to have, you know, equivalent performance on other measures of attention. I think that's a big open space, is trying to identify signatures of other types of attention. And all of this is building atop really foundational work on internal and external attention, alerting, orienting, and executive control are sort of well-known components of attention. And so I try and situate the sustained attention in that, and emphasize it's not superseding these results. It's just another component that's constantly at play in addition to these other forms of attention.
Okay. That's great. And it sort of sets things up in that regard. So, like, your attention is sort of like the general all-purpose sort of things that are sort of related in general to being successful generally, like at school or in the world, or, you know, to be able to focus enough that you can actually see through tasks or things like that. And then to that extent, you might do the task better or not. I mean, there's other factors, of course. But so as far as the task itself, and it seems like this has been your bread and butter sort of task for years, is a grad CPT. So could you describe the task and then describe maybe your first approach in terms of analyzing the data?
Yes, great question. So another serendipitous, I think, occurrence that just emphasizes, like, you can never predict where your path is headed. When I was a research assistant in between undergrad and grad school with Mike Esterman, also collaborating with Joe DeGutis at the Boston VA, they were sort of right in the middle of developing this task. So Mike Esterman coded up the first version of the grad CBT. And the idea was, when we measure sustained attention, there's attention. So you can either tax somebody's sustained attention by having them do a very boring task for a very long time, like historical sustained attention task where, you know, watch a clock hand move across a clock face for hours and notice when the second jumps 2 seconds instead of 1 second.
Oh my gosh.
So hours. Or, you know, another relevant kind of task that people used to do is sort of a radar detection task. You can imagine this is very relevant, looking at a radar and detecting very rare targets. So a good feature of these tasks is, you know, you're taxing sustained attention because people get worse over time. They experience what we call this vigilance decrement because they're so long and monotonous. What you don't know, what is like a challenge of these tasks is, well, one, you can't very easily collect brain data because, you know, hours and hours is much too long to have someone in the scanner at one time. But you also don't know in between those rare targets. So in between the rare, you know, 2 second hand jump or the submarine appearance on the radar detector, you don't actually know if people are attentive. They could be experiencing attention lapses, but you just don't have a measure of when that is happening. And so Mike Esterman said, okay, we want a task that is, we get frequent measures of attentiveness. So to capture these higher frequency fluctuations, but also you see a vigilance decrement, a hallmark of taxing sustained attention, which you don't see in other kinds of, you know, shorter tasks typically. And so the idea of the grad CBT, I'll tell you how to do it. So in the grad CBT, you see images that sort of fade from one to the next. There's no abrupt onset of one image to the next. The exact timing can differ, but maybe it's 800 milliseconds per image, maybe it's a second per image. So they're changing relatively rapidly. And your job is to just press a button in response to a frequent category, for example, city scenes, and then inhibit response to an infrequent category of images like mountain scenes. Okay. You can do indoor scenes, outdoor scenes, male and female faces, etc. But the idea is when people are kind of zoning out, they're getting distracted, they're mind wandering, they press more quickly and also more variably. So they have both much faster and much slower responses than their median response. And they also tend to make more errors. And the grad CBT is great because you see both a vigilance decrement, people do get worse over time, but you have that really high resolution measure of, you know, fluctuations in between relatively rare task errors or lapses because you can look at response time measures. Yeah. So that was the motivation of grad CBT. And it just works so well. I love it. I mean, I don't love performing it. I personally am terrible at it, you know, which is maybe why I study it, but it is, you know, a highly reliable task, which I think is especially important for predictive modeling. And yeah,
that's great. That's
great.
No, that's actually really cool. And then as far as how it's used. And so, I mean, you've done a number of iterations of either comparing, so it's done during the scan and you're looking at the subject's connectivity. So you actually take the overall performance after the scan, or it's like, well, initially the first study. So how do you work through doing the task and
I got it.
These networks? Yeah.
Yes. Great question. So for looking at individual differences, we just look at overall performance and that's based on your errors. So our, you know, very first behavioral metric, the individual differences metric we looked at was sensitivity. So how often people correctly responded when they should have responded and correct, you know, relative to when they false alarmed responded when they shouldn't have to those rare target images. And so we could measure everybody's performance. And in the very first study we did relating individual differences in functional connectivity to individual differences in performance on this task, which was sort of our stand-in for sustained attention function, we had people perform the task for about 36 minutes in the scanner, you know, broken up with some breaks and run breaks and rest breaks in the task, but it is a long time to perform that task. So we recruited, you know, a young adult non-clinical sample. And in that sample, we still saw a lot of variability in performance. You know, that individual differences metric was people's sensitivity overall. And then we related their functional connectivity patterns from, you know, either all the task data or separate resting state runs that we had collected to individual differences in that performance metric.
Okay. And then as far as so what you found then is subjects who performed generally better had a greater degree in connectivity of, there was a task positive sort of network and a task, or not a task negative, but ones which the ones performed worse had a stronger representation and then ones where they performed better. So, okay. So as far as that's concerned, okay, so that's a great task. And I think it does hit the sweet spot of, you know, continuous measures. It's boring. It's not, you know, horribly boring. It's kind of boring, but it's engaging still enough. And it's interesting, actually. I don't know, you know, if people, it's hard to predict, like if you're trying to look for something, like if you're trying to differentiate those with ADD versus normals, you could probably titrate a task that completely separates them further. But this is a good sort of, you know, getting the whole population sort of differences or things like that.
That's a good point. Which is that in all of sort of the predictive modeling work I've done, I've really been interested in modeling continuous measures of individual differences rather than discrete categories, you know, rather than classifying individuals as having a diagnosis or not. We use connectivity patterns to predict just variability within the population and performance on this task, and found the same model explained variability in ADHD, you know, symptom severity and frequency, rather than simply looking at difference between individuals with and without a diagnosis. Because we know within those groups, there's variability in performance, there's changes over time, and, you know, in addition to these group level effects that we see.
Yeah. No, that's actually really important. I mean, especially, we could even talk a little bit later about ADD, but, you know, you're right. It's probably, you know, unlike certain, maybe other things, it's, you know, some people might even argue it's not necessarily a disorder. I mean, it's not, you know, people struggle more in school, but it's sort of like, you know, some people would argue that it, you know, on some level it maybe was selected for in a certain population way back thousands of years ago when, you know, you had to be vigilant of many changing things in the environment. And so that those people with ADHD probably were more aware of that stuff.
I'm glad you bring up the point that, you know, more focus isn't always better. I think this is another trap that's easy to fall into, especially when predicting individual differences, more is better. And you can imagine times when sustained focus on a single task could be detrimental. And there's, you know, you have to have a balance between exploring and exploiting different features of the environment. And so that's why I do think it is important to think of sustained attention as just one component in with other types of attention. And in some of the work, you know, I've done since focusing on individual differences, looking at fluctuations in attentional states, you can also imagine that certain situations are benefited by different kinds of attentional states. Like, you know, certain tasks don't need your whole focus and may even, you know, be negatively affected if you focus too hard, right? Like, imagine you're playing a sport, you're trying to serve in tennis, and you like think too hard about what you're doing. That's when you mess up, right? Yeah. Like there are some times when actually more might not always be better.
Yeah. It's so interesting. It's this whole landscape of what information to be sensitive to. And okay. So you have this task and, you know, you've sort of developed along with others, you know, so 15 years ago, people would say, okay, you have a population does a task. They look at the activation. Other population doesn't, or does a task, maybe not as well. They look at activation. They try to normalize and compare. They might compare the magnitude and say, oh, there's a little bit of difference here and there. But obviously things have evolved a lot in fMRI. And you have, you know, basically a connectome based predictive model. And maybe loosely describe, if you could, you know, just sort of describe like generally the principles of how that's made.
Happy to. So another serendipitous, happenstance, Emily and I were friends, and Emily was working in a lab studying functional connectivity, and I was working in a lab studying attention, and, you know, differences between people and changes over time. And, you know, as we were brainstorming potential projects to work on together, Emily was working on work predicting individual differences. And so she developed connectome-based predictive modeling, you know, wrote the MATLAB script, and everyone said, oh, this is intuitive. This makes sense. And it works, right? And you can interpret the feature weight. So I always say, you know, it's like, I'm happy to try other fancier methods. I certainly have done that. Connectome-based predictive modeling, I like to say, is very straightforward, simple and elegant. So in connectome-based predictive modeling, right, the first step is to just identify a training set of individuals, so a subset of fMRI data and some to be predicted measure. Maybe it's a behavior score, like with GradCBT performance, and then you do feature selection. So again, lots of sophisticated ways to do this. The way that we originally did it was just relate in the training set differences in the behavior score to differences in the strength of every connection in the brain, defined with just a whole brain group level atlas, and then retained the connections that were significantly positively related to behavior and significantly negatively related to behavior. Of course, many of those probably are significant because we've done thousands of multiple comparisons. In our particular case, we use, you know, 268 node atlas developed by Sheila and Shen, and 35,778 functional connections. So you've done tons of comparisons. But, you know, then that's where we look at overall strength in those networks. So you get a single number, just average or sum of strength in the network positively and negatively related to behavior. And then you could just build a linear model relating those values to performance in the training set and bring in data from the test set, ask how that, you know, individual expresses these networks and use that value to predict their performance. So that's the connectome-based predictive modeling pipeline. It is, you know, now in an awesome GitHub repository maintained by the Constable Lab. There's other Python versions, I believe, that Emily has shared. And so that was the strategy we used, and we've compared it to other kinds of feature selection model building approaches. I don't think it's, you know, necessarily the best approach or the only approach to use, but it has been fruitful so far, and it is useful because you can interpret the feature weights, and we have existing models built with that technique that we can now externally validate. They're, you know, they're on GitHub, they're, I call them publication pre-registered, and so we can take them and apply them to new data. And so, yeah, that's what we
do. Okay. Yeah, no, actually, and it's really powerful. It's very, just trying to think about the principle of why it is so powerful. I mean, it is looking at, you know, it's sort of like, it's sort of parsing all these connectivity strengths and comparing against, with the training set. And so there's something useful, you know, the whole extreme multivariateness of it all sort of leverages its power, as opposed to just sort of like making a magnitude template or something like that. I think anything that looks at, you know, connectivity from one region to another, and, you know, then you suddenly have this multiplication of different variables to use to sort of that to associate with the behavior. That's really just powerful. And I think you're right.
Exactly. It also allows you to look at data collected at rest. So this is another sort of practical and theoretical, I think, strength, which is, you know, there's no baseline in rest. And so you can't get those same activation measures you could when looking at task data and doing traditional GLMs, for example. But we could calculate these connectivity patterns and make predictions from resting state data, which lets us make this theoretical claim about sustained attention, right? So sustained attention is not something that just appears in the brain when you're actively sustaining attention to a particular goal or task. Sustained attention is decodable from functional brain organization, even when you're not like actively sustaining attention to any particular task or action or behavior. And so I think that's a cool kind of theoretical piece that is a benefit that comes along with the practical benefit of looking at connectivity, which allows us to, you know, make use of resting state data, which are now, you know, widely available in the field.
That's a really good point. Getting into ways of sort of analyzing or looking at the resting state data, and also even looking from moment to moment changes in attention. That's a second, but basically, yeah, you had this Nature Neuroscience paper. I think the first one, so I didn't know, actually, just to back up a second, I didn't know that that was Emily's method. I didn't know that she did connectome-based predictive modeling.
Connectome-based predictive modeling it's the very first paper it was used in is the fingerprinting paper. It's used to predict fluid intelligence.
Okay, so that was I know about her
finger. It was a couple months before, yeah. So I love just like the I always ask people about just the history of their projects and their papers, because it's interesting to kind of see behind the scenes. But yeah, the papers come out a few months apart. I forget exactly what the timeline was, but yeah. So she, in that paper, it is used in the 112, I believe, subject HCP release to predict individual differences in fluid intelligence. And so the subsequent paper that our team published about a neuromarker of sustained attention used the method to predict individual differences in task performance in a small sample of, you know, adults doing the grad CBT, but then generalized the model to a separate group of individuals with and without ADHD who had clinician-rated ADHD symptom scores. And so that was the, you know, first paper to do the generalization across data sets, which is a big, you know, I can get on my pulpit and I think that's a really important part of the process. From there, we've used it in dynamic ways and across different kinds of data sets. That was the original origin and use of the method.
That is great. It's interesting. This whole, like you said, this whole realm of, you know, how people develop their ideas and all this idea space, and somehow, right. I mean, Emily's paper on fingerprinting caught my attention. I mean, I caught, you know, a lot of people's attention, but somehow that sort of blocked the origination of this idea. So that's interesting that you bring that out. So going on to just the network itself. And so I could,
yes.
And also you had a paper in PNAS in 2020. I mean, the whole continuation of papers, and you pretty much have this network, and there's, it's mentioned many places. We've used this network. We collaborated a little bit with you with David Jangra and looking at reading. And this network predicted reading comprehension. So just to look at the network, I mean, and obviously it's hard on a podcast. I wish we had, you know, it's one of the things that this app doesn't have is ways of displaying slides, but because there's a lot of information here, the circle plot with, you know, the high attention network and low attention network. And this is a big, this is actually just a, my side thing. It's really a hard thing in fMRI, especially connectivity, to really find a good way of displaying connectivity information without being, you know, it's people that use matrices, people use circle plots, people use, they try to go in the surface of the brain. And usually they're overwhelmed. People are overwhelmed with the information, so much so that it's hard to, you know, look at something and say, ah, okay, that's obvious. You know, I could tell like the high attention network is more dense, but one thing that did pop out that I, that kind of took me by surprise, but then I dug in the literature a little bit after reading this paper, is that the cerebellum seems hugely important. I mean, it just, that's the first thing that pops out. The cerebellum connections with the parietal and temporal areas, with the high attention network and the low attention network, it's connected only with itself. And it's sort of disconnected more or less. And once again, we'll take a sidestep in terms of interpreting connectivity, but still, yeah, I dug in the literature. It seems that there's some relationship between cerebellum size and ADHD, and you know, people are finding it's more important than just, you know, motor control or things like that. So
yeah, it's such a good question. I mean, I could spend the whole podcast diving into the teenies of the network, and it's like, it's so tricky. So I think this is related to a point that I alluded to before about the, like, the pros and cons of having a model and sticking with it right now and validating it and identifying its predictive boundaries versus constantly updating and developing new models. So we have, you know, this set of networks, high attention network, low attention network, they're anti-correlated with each other by design, right? Because they were originally selected to be positively and negatively related to behavior. Yeah. So it's not necessarily like a two-factor model in which they're competing. We've sort of forced the model to identify connections that were inversely related to each other. And so I think it's an open question, what is the necessary and sufficient set of connections to predict sustained attention? And I think it will be a subset of this network that appears in many different studies. And so in my lab now, we're collecting some data with auditory attention tasks and asking, you know, what networks predict those tasks and how does that overlap with these networks originally designed to predict performance on a visual attention task? So that's all to say that, you know, the anatomy of the most ideal, you know, generalizable networks may change over time, but this set of connections has been very generalizable and, you know, generalizing to, I think, 8 data sets collected by multiple labs, over 2,000 participants to predict individual differences and changes in attention over time. And so it is interesting to look at the anatomy, and absolutely the cerebellar effect jumps out at me. So there's connections between left and right cerebellar hemispheres in the low attention network. Why is that? I also had the exact same, you know, approach. I had come from default mode network and dorsal attention network and ventral attention network. And I said, wait, this doesn't map onto that. They don't even show the cerebellum in those plots. Right. But as you said, I also, you know, read meta-analyses. There are structural changes in ADHD in the cerebellum that are consistent. And I think more and more evidence that the cerebellum is involved in cognitive function and attentional processes. And so I think of these data-driven approaches as hypothesis generators. So, you know, because there's probably connections here that are idiosyncratic to the 25 people that the networks were defined on or the grad CBT, it's hard to think of them as hypothesis testing, but I think they're generating new hypotheses that are interesting to test. And we can use other kinds of methods to say, well, what if we perturb these connections in some way? Do we see expected, you know, downstream effects on attention? And it is, I think, providing converging evidence with evidence from very different kinds of modalities, different literature about the importance of different regions in attention function. And so, yeah.
Okay. All right. Yeah, no, that's actually, you bring up a lot of really good points. And actually, this is a perfect place to get into that too, is that, you know, these, you know, some people might argue, well, you're just using this as sort of like a black box. You're saying, okay, these are all these features and they help predict a behavior, but they don't really get at mechanisms. I mean, people are wondering, you know, what is it about the cerebellum? What is there some subcortical, you know, control mechanism, and everything in the cortex that we're looking at is sort of like an epiphenomenon of this sort of thing, or how does that work? And so this doesn't say that, but like you said, it seems that, you know, either you could do, you know, right, neuromodulation, or you could even, I mean, I guess you could also, you know, right, you could also, you know, take away some parts of these networks to see how predictable it still is, and maybe it might be differently predictable in some sense. I mean, that, you could do it post-processing or with neuromodulation of some sort.
Yes, that's exactly right. We've done this kind of computational lesioning approach to say, well, when does the network fail? Like, what connections do we need to exclude for the network to fail? Shocking, or maybe not that surprisingly, the network is pretty robust to that kind of computational lesioning. I personally think sustained attention is distributed signal. We have more recent evidence about sort of large scale latent state fluctuations that are tracking sustained attention. That work was led by a PhD student in my lab, Hyung Song. And so I think we're looking at a very distributed signal. So this network is just robust to that kind of lesioning. But we have tried perturbation in other ways. So one way is working with data in which individuals have been given pharmacological interventions that either enhances or, you know, decreases sustained attention function. And we actually see that in individuals given a single dose of methylphenidate or Ritalin before a scan, they show stronger high attention network, weaker low attention network. When you look at then controls, so that's a between subject study. When you look at within subject studies, we actually, with anesthetic agents, we find the opposite. So individuals given sevoflurane and propofol actually show stronger low attention networks and weaker high attention networks. And so it's not causal evidence, but it's starting to say, okay, when we perturb cognitive, attentional, and even consciousness states, we see expected effects on these networks. I have one paper in collaboration with Dustin Shinas and others looking at real-time neurofeedback. Like, can we train people to increase strength in the high attention network, decrease strength in the low attention network, and will that show benefits for performance? That paper was a proof of principle for connectome-based neurofeedback. And so, you know, showing the method works, it was a relatively small sample, so we didn't find effects on behavior. But I think that's a pretty interesting direction to go in to test the causal relationship between these features and, you know, the attentional processes we're interested in.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious about that. So, you know, there's different types of neurofeedback. I mean, did you use sort of like a conscious neuro, like, so, right, giving the network strength as a measure back to the subject, and they saw it, they tried to figure out a way of increasing their attention?
Yes, that's exactly what we did, sort of a gas gauge. So people did a short block of the grad CBT, and then we showed them feedback on the gas gauge about their, you know, attention network strength during the preceding block. Then they would do it again, and we would try them, you know, try and keep the gauge as close to full as you can. It's hard because when you do connectivity blockwise, you have to have enough time to calculate reliable connectivity. And so, yeah, you know, I personally think people didn't get enough feedback. I think that's a big question for neurofeedback, you know, studies, how much feedback is necessary. And so, you know, it's hard to interpret the null results, but that's how we originally did it. And I think with the, you know, new advances in terms of looking at, you know, TR to TR co-fluctuation, there might be ways to get finer grain measures and give more frequent feedback to people.
And I also, right, regarding neurofeedback, I've always been really intrigued. I've talked to this researcher, Mikhail Ramat, who does sort of a covert sort of way. So basically,
yes. Yeah,
I mean, you can imagine the network is fluctuating along, and whenever it kind of hits upon the high attention network, you have some sort of stimulus that gives some sort of a dopamine response or something. And so then people are reinforced potentially covertly, and that could also be, you know, so there's so many ways of playing with this that you could, yeah, reinforce these networks.
Yeah, that is super interesting. I know her work well, and I was lucky to go to a real-time neurofeedback conference, I think about a year ago, and just learn about all the different, you know, feedback approaches. And so we're, you know, planning different ways to use that in my lab. I'm now particularly interested in latent state-based neurofeedback. We haven't attempted it yet, but I think this would be an interesting thing to try given the associations we've seen between attention fluctuations and brain state fluctuations. But that's a future work.
And before while we're on this topic, I just, you know, it's a random place to bring it up, but I actually, it's funny because being at the University of Chicago, you probably people at the psychology department have brought up, oh, I can't pronounce his name, Mihaly Setsetmekali.
Yes. I was you know, so fascinated by this work, even as a research assistant. And so now that I'm here, there's like a plaque in the department and his name is on it, and it's very exciting. So I know the flow work.
Yeah. And so that's interesting too, because I mean, that's sort of, obviously it's a different type of attention. It's sort of engagement, mm-hmm. but one thing that when people define flow is sort of like, you know, where the effort matches the interest. And so you just kind of get sucked into this sort of effortless attention. And one thing that defines it is sort of a decrease in sort of frontal connections in some sense, there's not been many studies on it, but it seems that there's some similarity between the high attention network and slow and flow state.
That is such a good question. And it's a question we've tried to answer somewhat empirically, not exactly with flow, but with a different kind of attention. So one criticism you may have of grad CBT is, yes, you can sustain attention to it, but are you ever really like that attentive to the task as you would be if you were, you know, watching your favorite TV show or listening to an amazing piece of music? Like it feels like a different experience. And so Hai Young Song, the PhD student whose work I mentioned earlier, came into the lab and was really interested in how people are attending to narratives. And, you know, because it feels like just this different kind of experience. And so she ran an excellent reanalysis project where she reanalyzed data collected while people were listening to a story, and a separate data set collected while people were watching the TV show Sherlock, so famous data set shared by Janice Chen and YC Leung and colleagues, and asked if she could identify network dynamics that predict changes in people's engagement to those narrative stimuli. And so we had separate behavioral participants come into the lab and rate how engaging they found every moment of those, the story and the TV show. And we found that there were networks whose dynamics predicted these group average engagement dynamics, and those overlapped with the high and low attention networks. Huh. And so we thought, you know, we also found that the, you know, most engaging moments of those narratives were emotionally charged moments. And so we sort of think of this narrative engagement as emotionally valenced sustained attention or emotion laden sustained attention. And that gets to this idea that there's this core network related to paying attention to different things, but then maybe pieces on top of that network that are related to performing a task versus being engaged in the narrative, which is not exactly flow, but I think maybe closer to this state. Yeah. I'm really interested in other kinds of, you know, experiences that elicit flow. People talk about video games or playing sports or other kinds of like puzzles and challenges. So far, we have not figured out how to induce this in the scanner, but I think our narratives are a good way to start getting at this more naturalistic kind of attentional experience. We all know what that feels like.
Yeah, exactly. So along those lines as well, I mean, it seems like one of the definitions of flow state is sort of like your maximum bit rate in terms of bringing information in. And it would be interesting, you know, for people who are psychophysicists or whatever to collaborate with, to the idea of like somehow titrating with the stimulus, like the bit rate of information, and trying to sort of like, you know, compare people's bit rate.
Yeah, like basically matching the difficulty of the task to how much what people's ideal would be. You know, this is so interesting. We have never tried this in the scanner. That would be a cool kind of feedback experiment. Like, can you manipulate the way the task is looking based on signatures of attention to maximize people's performance? Anna Korovyu is a PhD student in my lab who is actually at NIH and Chris Baker's lab as a postdoc. Okay. And she has done some work with this with pupillometry. So asking if you can make a task easier or harder based on pupil signatures of attention in order to kind of keep people on task and rescue them from lapses. And no conclusion so far, but that is definitely something we're thinking about and could be interesting to adapt in terms of, you know, using fMRI signatures of attention in addition to or instead of, measures from eye tracking.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is great. So let's talk a little bit about your current work. And so along the line, so initially you had the grad CPT, you have this high and low attention network, you can predict individuals, you know, where they fall on this curve. But then you've gone on to push the envelope in terms of looking at moment to moment attention changes. So, and how far do you think you can push that? And in what way would you push that? So how do you do things differently to sort of pull out the moment-to-moment differences?
So. Yeah, that's a great question. So I think, like, as an my fMRI researcher hat is, you know, one method that I'm super, super excited about. We have one preprint and another one coming soon is this method developed by Josh Faskowitz and Rick Betzel and Olaf Sporns. And they're, you know, awesome team looking at measures of co-fluctuation. So at every TR, looking at the product of the normalized time series, you know, in every different region or node of the brain, and using that as a measure of whether region's activity is deflecting in the same direction at every moment in time. And I think that is going to give us, or is already giving us, more high resolution measures of these network dynamics than we've been able to look at with sliding window approaches or other kinds of approaches that we've previously applied to fMRI time series. And so that is a method I'm particularly excited about. Happy to talk more about that if you want to get into it.
Yeah, might as well. So maybe not in the details, but it's sort of the principle. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, Josh is, and among others, has been sort of, you know, and obviously you've been applying it really well. It's kind of funny how research works. I was mentioning to you before we started the podcast that that, you know, Josh, who developed this EDGE technique, which basically is all it is really taking each time series and, you know, people, when they say, oh, this time series is a high correlation with this other time series, they look at the whole time series. Or people do window analysis where they take the average of maybe a minute, which is still kind of slow. And what EDGE is taking, you know, point by point, multiplying the time series essentially, and seeing, you know, where things fluctuate. It sort of amplifies this correlation. It's like co-activation patterns in some sense. But Josh has been doing this, but then your paper came along, and you know, I saw this, and I'm like, Josh, we have to, you know sure, it's great to develop the method, but you know, we need to find ways of testing the method like this.
And well, it's so funny. I actually gave a Zoom colloquium at Indiana, and you know, in deep COVID lockdowns, and got to chat. You know, the EDGE papers had just come out, and I got to chat with everyone about them. And I was so inspired. I came to my lab and I said, like, what can we do with this? Can we predict these moment-to-moment attention fluctuations? And the preprint you're referring to was led by Henry Jones, who's a PhD student here at UChicago that I collaborate with. And he applied GLM to EDGE time series to identify, you know, networks that fluctuate with these really high frequency in fMRI land, again, not other kinds of measure, electrophysiological measure land, fluctuations in attention index by response times on the grad CBT in two different data sets. And he found really interestingly that we can find edges related to attention fluctuations and attention lapses, and about, you know, 30% of those edges are not predicted by the activation in the two regions that we are comparing alone. And so there's, you know, there's this additional information added by looking at EDGE time series, which I think makes it a really powerful method. And we have a preprint just about to come out in a couple of weeks by Ziwei Zhang, a PhD student in my lab, using these EDGE time series in a predictive model sense to predict surprising moments. And she has actually found, using open data sets, that you can find edges that, you know, reliably predict surprising moments in a learning task. So you're just learning where rewards are going to appear. Yeah. And those same networks predict people's surprise when they're watching NCAA basketball games. And this is a data set shared by James Anthony. And so there's this context general network dynamics predicting these moments of surprise, which occur like rapidly, instantaneously. And I think without this higher frequency measure, we wouldn't be able to capture those quite as well. And so we call that EDGE fluctuation-based predictive modeling, EFPM. Coming soon. I love it. We've thought long and hard about that.
That's awesome. That is awesome. And yeah, edges are great as far as, as far as, you know, if you have an hypothesis, if you like know which areas you want to sort of start to compare, you can use them. Otherwise, your data sort of explodes. If you want to do, you know, every voxel with every other voxel over time, then you have suddenly, you know, way too much data to deal with. But so that's the trick about edges. It's powerful, but you kind of have to know kind of where to look and what hypothesis to test.
Yes. Otherwise it'll break your laptop. You know, it's a very computationally intensive, but I think there, it's really a lot of open questions there. And I'm excited to, you know, apply these kinds of methods to answer other questions.
Yeah, yeah. And also, it reminded me when you mentioned fast changes, it seems also, and then you know, you could do simultaneous EEG, simultaneous, and you know, we also are studying pupil dilation. And what could also be, I mean, in basic neuroscience research has also looked at sort of spontaneous, is there a time constant to spontaneous changes in attention? You know, can you characterize that? And maybe that's a biomarker of something or something.
That is interesting, right? Like when we talk about how well people pay attention, we talk about attention span. Like we don't have a measure of attention span. What is that measure? We've always thought, you know, maybe there's this a characteristic frequency with which your attention fluctuates and we can isolate that frequency. So far I have not figured out a good way to do it, but I hope, you know, other people are working on it too and we can all come to some kind of breakthroughs. I think that it's an interesting question and it does seem relevant in addition to, you know, your mean level of sustained attention in various contexts. The frequency with which you fluctuate is also very impactful. Attention lapses have consequences for memory and learning and in the moment performance and, you know, understanding when and why they happen and, you know, why they happen differently across people, I think is,
yeah,
you know, $1 million question.
Yeah. And maybe it is the people with ADHD who have like just a higher amplitude fluctuation that's sort of harder to control with the cognitive control. And so, you know, people with lower amplitude is more controllable and disruptible. Who knows? But yeah. So right. That's like any technique with any population, sort of it opens up these new questions. And yeah, it would be great to look at EEG or other things like that simultaneously, especially for predictive sort of analysis.
Yeah, we're also starting to collect some FNIRS data, which I'm totally new to, but really excited about the opportunities for collecting the data in a less, you know, restrictive environment than the magnet. And so, yeah.
Oh, that's so cool. Right. That's also very cool. So, yeah. and of course, you know, the goal, I mean, that's the thing about, you know, fMRI research is like the goal is to sort of come up with these markers that predict and help characterize people, but also sort of lead to understand mechanisms. And that kind of naturally leads us to sort of the last sort of topic. You know, it's funny, I bring this up in many different contexts because it was such an interesting paper and we discussed it on the podcast earlier, not us, but you know, it was discussed in the podcast earlier. There are several other ones where this BWAS paper saying, oh, well, what are you doing with these individual subjects? You know, how could you say anything about them? Because, you know, you need 2000 subjects to make a statement about populations. But you and Emily wrote a paper in 2022, Nature Neuroscience, in which you argued that, you know, no, that's not really the case. And actually, even to give them credit, and you actually mentioned this in your paper, that to give the authors of that paper, the Merrick et al. Paper, credit, they also, I mean, the WashU group studies deep imaging of individual subjects. They do this. And so what was your main point that you brought out in that paper?
We had overall points, which is, that is often true, but we don't know if it's true unless we test it empirically. And so I would say that the main take home point is just test, you know, is the model generalizable and predictive? If it's not, by all means, sample size is important. We need to be running well-powered studies. We can be easily fooled by, you know, underpowered studies, seeing exaggerated effect sizes in small samples. And so we just need to empirically test. And the way that we do that is by sharing data, which people, I think, already do. We have big open data sets. We have individual labs sharing data on sites like Open Neuro, which is excellent. We need to do more of that. But also we need to do model sharing. So share your predictive models, let other people validate them and document when do these models generalize, when do they fail, to understand, is this a non-generalizable model or is it a model that generalizes in a particular population, like young adults? Does it fail when applied, for example, to developmental samples? There's a sort of wing of my lab looking at how models can tell us about developmental changes in networks that predict different aspects of attention and cognition. So share your data, share your models, validate the models and record the validations, because if we don't test it, we won't know if they're generalizable or not. Another really important thing to keep in mind is that you need to be predicting reliable measures. So if the measure that you want to predict is not itself reliable, your prediction cannot be very good. The ceiling of predictive power is the reliability of your measure. And so focusing on well-validated, reliable behavioral measures, maybe that's task performance, you know, that's performance on tasks whose reliability has been assessed. That's a good way to go. Also, you know, using multivariate approaches that take advantage of patterns of brain features rather than individual features in isolation often buys you a lot in terms of predictive power. I might have forgotten something. No, I don't have the paper in front of me. Did I get everything?
Well, yeah, I'm just trying to think about anything that, well, and there's also something that, right, no, I think everything you said was exactly right. I mean, it makes sense to me. And just a little bit of all of those, can you bootstrap you to, you know, to maybe getting down at least in order, you know, maybe an order of magnitude less. So all of those things combined. And I think the main thing that you mentioned is, you know, the you're looking at a very specific measure of the ability to attend. Whereas, you know, a lot of papers make these ambitious sort of, you know, goals of psychosis or schizophrenia, which is very multidimensional. And there's many different reasons for having those disorders. And maybe there is for attention, but at least it was something that hits upon a network that.
Yes, I think that's also something is we shouldn't expect, you know, there's the excellent papers that have come out recently, right? Models fail to generalize for people that aren't in line with sample stereotypes. That paper was led by Abigail Green from Yale. And so thinking about, like, we shouldn't expect models to predict everything. I think attention, again, just happenstance, it happens to be something that's a pretty distributed signal, at least sustained attention, that we can measure reliably and therefore predict with, you know, not perfect, not even amazing, but relatively good statistically significant accuracy. But we shouldn't expect all measures to be predictable. And we should also, you know, think carefully about our training and test sets. So thinking about, do we expect models to generalize to all populations equally? Do we think there's going to be differences? How much do we want to tailor models to particular age groups or groups of individuals and so on? So paying attention to all that is important.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many different ways of taking this. And I think I totally agree. And I think actually everyone in the field kind of agrees. I mean, that was an example of a paper that, you know, gets picked up by the popular press and it gets blown out of proportion. And,
but I think I agree. We all agree. Like, know many of the authors and are amazing. I've collaborated with some of them and it's, you know, I don't think we disagree. It's just, again, in how the message is picked up and framed. And so we can appreciate, I think it made a really good point about we need to focus on reliable measures and we can be fooled into thinking that, you know, predictions are significant and robust and reliable when they're really not. But we can do things about that again. We can test that empirically. That's the main takeaway.
Go on. Sorry.
Oh, no, go ahead.
Oh, no. I was just saying that, the other thing is, you know, there's now sort of a question of, you know, how much dynamic measures are sensitive. And once again, we can test them empirically. We can actually see if they're very, very.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Right. That's it. Just test, you know, are they predictable? Do they generalize across people and data sets? Do they buy you new information that you don't get from static measures alone? I think that's a really interesting question that I think we don't actually often ask in our brain-based models, but is important. How much do these brain models add above and beyond what we can get from other easier to collect measures? It is interesting to think about the unique predictive power of different types of task measures, questionnaire measures, brain measures. If we want to think practically, I think, you know, we need to see, are our measures telling us something we couldn't know from a much easier and cheaper to collect
just a questionnaire source? Or
right, exactly, yeah,
pupil dilation or something like that. But I mean, the brain point though is to try to, obviously people have the goal of trying to say, okay, you see the brain, it's more direct and it somehow maybe give you a insight into mechanism or neuromodulation or something for at least in the context of attention sort of correcting. One other point from the Merrick paper that I always think of when I look at these networks and I look at even, you know, Emily's fingerprinting as well, is that, and it's always a problem in my head, and in terms of when you compare multiple brains and you try to put brains into a template and you have like right now you have the Shin Atlas where, you know, you have, you know, you put parcelate. It seems to me that there's a lot that could be improved in terms of, you know, making sure that, you know, either by doing deep imaging or whatever, making sure that the brains when you warp them into a template, that that those parcels in that brain really do line up with the template parcels in reality. It seems like that's an open problem that could contribute to some reduction of sensitivity as well.
I completely agree. Yes. And I think there has been convincing work suggesting that individualized atlases can improve prediction. One reason we have not gone in that direction is, again, this problem of we have this, you know, publication pre-registered network. And so we, instead of tweaking it on every new advance, have kind of left it alone and applied it and then built new networks and looked at overlap and so on. But I agree. I think there is more work to be done. The nodes we typically look at and I think are often used in whole brain connectivity studies, but not always, are pretty big. And so we're smoothing over, you know, maybe a lot of variability across people, but there still is variability. We know that there's also variability, not just across people, but within, within the same person over time, you know, depending on what they're doing, the parcellation that best fits the data will change. And so I think that is really tricky to think about. Do we need individualized state specific atlases? Do we need, should we just need to go the voxel wise route and hyper align everyone, right? Like, what is the ideal? Yeah. I think this is a really big, interesting question. And I'm, you know, following advances in the literature, and I love to learn more. If anyone out there has suggestions, like, send them my way. I think there's a lot more we can do than sticking to the single, you know, group level atlas that our models are currently in. But I will say we have tried other atlases to show it's, you know, results aren't tied to that one parcellation.
Yeah, I mean, your results are great. I mean, in terms of being robust and applicable to many things, it's just a really robust thing. Okay, so this is great. So, and sort of you hinted at the you know, the one future is sort of coming up with, right, even more sensitive models, understanding mechanisms, maybe registering the data better, deep imaging, simultaneous measures, neuromodulation. But so one last thing I like to usually end with, that that people seem like they really like it. You know, a lot of younger people listen to this podcast. And so, and you pretty much have just started. What was that like moving from Yale to University of Chicago? And is there any lessons or experiences that you've had that are worth, that you would want to convey?
It's such a good question. I started my lab at the University of Chicago in summer 2019. And then, of course, COVID happened right at the beginning of 2020. And so it was a weird time, no matter what your position was. And it was certainly not how I expected starting the lab. But I think, you know, lots of people give advice and it's like not clear what will work best for everyone until they try it out. One thing that really resonated with me was working with a lot of different mentors. I've been just incredibly lucky to work with amazing mentors. Todd and Marvin, as you mentioned, my postdoc mentor, BJ Casey. I think working with different mentors, you know, even just through collaborating or getting to know them, going to their lab meeting, is a great way to see that everybody has a different path. If there were just one way to succeed in this field, everybody would look the same, like everybody would behave the same, have the same writing style, but everybody has a different approach in terms of their mentoring style, their research style, what kind of ideas they're excited about. And so just seeing that variability and learning about, okay, everybody took a different route to getting here. Some people went to industry and came back. Some people started in psychology. Some people started in physics. Was a good way to say, I don't need to try and emulate this other way of being because there's many. And if I try that, I'm just emulating the average of like a lot of variability and that average is out to nothing, right? I don't know. And so it made me more confident in just, you know, embracing my own style and going forward with that. So I don't know if it's a piece of advice, but the concrete takeaway, I guess, would be to just, you know, get to know as many mentors as you can and work with supportive mentors who you trust and work well with, and take and leave different pieces of their approach that you find works for you.
That's awesome advice. And really, I think, and the other flip side of that is to, like you said, just be yourself. And, you know, it's honestly, you know, the mentors, you know, they truly haven't figured things out in terms of the best way to be as well. Everyone's struggling. Everyone's trying to figure things out.
I see that now as a mentor myself. Like I realize now that is absolutely true. I don't have it all figured out, but I do my best to help the students and give suggestions, and then appreciating that's, you know, everybody's approach, I think is good to realize.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, on that note, this was great. Thank you so much for coming on, and And I wish you the best in the future. I'm sure I'm looking forward to your papers coming out and continuing forward.
So. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thanks for inviting me. Yeah, it's really fun to chat and I appreciate it.
All right. Well, thanks. Thanks.
Neurosalience is brought to you by Organization for Human Brain Mapping. This week's episode is produced by Ömer Faruk Gülban